What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I am Pete.
And we are coming to you live from the Philadelphia Convention Center. There is a packed room of 500 people
Woo-hoo!
Here. Going up. Thanks. Or a couple of people. It's the first con.
It sounds like 500.
It's important people. Yeah. That's the important thing.
Yeah.
We're very excited to be here. There's a long comics history, of course, in Philadelphia. You have that one arc in Venom where Venom was working out of Philadelphia.
Right, yeah.
And
there was a Rocky comic, wasn't there?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, well then... Take that off the list.
We are very excited to be here, though, and we're very excited about the guest that we have with us today. He's one of our favorite writers from way back with an amazing series called Skull Kickers.
Yep.
He is now writing for Marvel's Champions, a book called Wayward, which is superb, from Image Comics. If you listen to the podcast at all, you've definitely heard us talk about that. Ladies and gentlemen, Jib Zub!
Yeah!
Ooh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming.
We're so excited you can do this. What's the con been like for you so far?
It's been good. I mean, it's a first year show. It's a first year show, so it's a little quiet. But honestly, the social's been good. The people here have been wonderful. I got to tell you, just in general, the city's been great. People have been very, very kind, and had great social stuff, interactions, hanging out with friends, and talking to people, signing books. Yeah, it's been good overall.
And we were talking about this right before. You're from Toronto.
That's right.
We hear the best poutine in Philadelphia is across the street. Are you going to check it out afterwards?
You going to check it out, man?
I think as soon as I do, I'd spontaneously combust. I'm not allowed to have Canadian comfort food anywhere else but in Canada.
That makes sense.
It's sort of like if I walk into a pancake place and they don't have maple syrup, I have to like immediately leave because my skin will start burning or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Do you bring your own maple syrup with you everywhere?
Doesn't everyone?
Of course.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, a little hip holster.
That's right. So bring it.
Are you going to get a cheesesteak, though, while you're here?
I already have.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
What'd you get?
You can't tell? Jeez, they really pack on the pounds. No, it was really good. Just like a classic. It was really nice. Yeah, yeah. Have had all kinds of, all the meats this weekend. It's been very good. I had like a roast pork sandwich the other day. I had a cheesesteak the first day. I had a really nice burger. And yeah, I'm just going to go home and eat salads for a day straight. So,
well, let's talk about the books because you got a ridiculous amount of stuff going on. I want to talk about Wayward first.
Sure.
So for those who aren't reading it, we're getting very much towards the end here. So this is probably not the best time to jump in with the newest
issue.
It's
the perfect time to jump in.
Oh, is it? Well, you have two issues left at this point, and it is going to be collected in collections. But what's the pitch for the book for those who haven't read it?
So when the book launched in 2014, we sort of said it's like Buffy in Japan. So it's teenagers fighting Japanese mythological monsters on the streets of Tokyo. And that was a really good sort of, you know, get you in the door kind of pitch. It gives you those notes of like, there's going to be teen drama and angst, violence, you know, sass. And that worked really well for the opener. The series has evolved a lot since then. That's still how I pitch it to new readers, because you're going to be starting with those kinds of notes. But then very quickly, after the first arc, honestly, we put some real spins on it in terms of the mythological elements that we're using, the kind of character drama that we're building, and the depth and breadth of the cast. We've got a lot of characters, a lot of different interactions. It's easily the most difficult thing I'm writing right now because, first of all, it's creator-owned, so you put your, you know, you're all into it. Not that I don't on my commercial stuff, but you want to get it absolutely right every single time, and you don't have that kind of editorial oversight on it. You're your own kind of boss, so you're extra paranoid. But it's also a real location, so all the places in Tokyo and the other places that we've gone in the series have all been built off of real geography and real locations, which is cool, real mythological history. And so I do a ton of research on it. And Stephen Cummings, my collaborator, who lives in Yokohama, just outside of Tokyo, he goes out and like shoots photo ref of locations.
Oh,
like
cool.
I'll send him Google Earth links and be like, maybe they're fighting in this park. And he'll be like, oh, cool. Okay. What's near there? Even if it doesn't show up in the series, it just sort of gives the, you know, Tokyo is like another character in the series.
Basically setting up a geocaching adventure.
Oh,
for
totally.
Him.
Yeah. And it's been fun actually, because some of the readers who have gone on trips to Tokyo or live over there, they've tracked down a bunch of those locations and they've shot photos and just sort of, it's kind of fun. A couple of the places I had never physically been to, but we had Google Earth toured around And then I went there many months later, and it was really weird because I kind of felt like I knew the place. And I was like, oh, we destroyed this place. I feel kind of bad now. It's really pretty, you know.
So you have spent a bunch of time in Japan, though.
Yeah. It sounds so weird saying this out loud. I've been to Japan 12 times.
Wow.
I love it. Yeah. My wife and I, we traveled there multiple times for, I use hanging air quotes, research trips. But honestly, yeah, for research and also just for conventions and just for fun. We were there for like our honeymoon, and aww. I've gone on a couple longer trips. So I did a sabbatical in 2016, so I was there for like 6 weeks, and we were touring around Tokyo, Osaka, Kyoto, and a bunch of smaller areas as well.
So you mentioned this before, that it started out as kind of Buffy, but with Japanese folklore. Yeah. We've compared it a little bit now to X-Men, but with Japanese folklore.
Thanks. Yeah.
What's it like expanding a book from essentially a solo book to a team book? What are the challenges there?
It was always the kind of plan, right, from the start, that Rory, who's the main character, she would be our touchstone to bring other people in, you know, so that even if you knew nothing about Japan or Japanese mythology, as she learned about it, you would learn about it, and then we could open you up to the rest of the cast. And so it was built into the concept right from the get-go. But wanting to get that right, and the interpersonal relationships of the characters and all the different yokai. So there are these, you know, spirits and monsters of kind of mythological Japan. There are hundreds of them, and the variety and the depth and breadth of them are amazing. And I love putting them into the story because they are so different from kind of the Britannic or Germanic, in myths, you know, that we grew up with. And same thing with the Greek and Roman myths. Like, there's the Japanese ones are so out there, and they reflect the culture just as the European ones do. They reflect some of the priorities and the kinds of stories that you tell children and the things you want them to grow up understanding. And we can then echo some of those themes in the story by which creatures we bring in and what we sort of say about them. So it's been cool.
And on that note, if you're not picking up the book, one of my favorite things about it is you have a lot of back matter issue, which is great and super helpful.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, one of the things I wanted was I didn't want to have to do... I wanted the characters to be able to speak very naturally, so I didn't want to have that thing. And it's totally a reasonable thing in most comics, but if you need to explain something to the reader, so you have someone go, as you know, Bob, you know, and then they tell you information that everyone already knows. Like, I didn't want these Japanese people, like, trying to explain to each other what... would be real common sort of fairy tales and folklore. And so they'll reference some of this stuff. And then if you go into the back matter, almost all of that's written by Zach Davison, who's this Eisner Award winning Japanese translator and monster scholar, which that's a great
job. Wow. Cool job.
I want that job.
He writes these essays sort of expanding upon the things that we touch upon in the comic. So you can just get a sense of, oh, that's a creepy ghost monster. And then he will be like, the reason why this is really cool and some of the thematic stuff that you may not realize, and he'll drill down deeper. Whenever I do the creator-owned stuff, I always try, and it's very indulgent. Obviously, creator-owned books are about, you know, those creators making the book they always wanted to without any kind of filters. So the back matter stuff is things I love about comics. You can dig deeper. You can have those cool essays and making of materials. And so I wanted the ability to put a lot of that in there. And I don't mind, you know, taking the extra time and the money to do that, because I think that the aggregate, bonus from readers, you know, you're spending more time with the book, you're getting more invested in it. There's more there to discover, you know, like you get a nice solid 22 page story. And then you, if you want, you can read these essays, like you're going to spend some time with this book and really hopefully be enveloped in it. And that's important to me.
Now, you've, as we mentioned, wrapped up a creator-owned book before with Skull Kickers, but now you're heading to the end here. What's different about it this time?
It feels really good, both with Skull Kickers and this time, to have a complete thing. I think it's really valuable to be able to end things. One of the difficult parts about working on superhero books is that they're constantly stuck in the second act, right? Because you can't completely play off a plot line. Or if you do, someone can always bring it back, you know? You can't kill that villain. You can't end that relationship. You can't finish that plot line, because in that soap operatic sequential way, it's got to be able to be, you know, it's all material that can be mined in the future, and I can actually put a button on it, which is a cool feeling. As much as I do love series, I like that feeling of a cohesive finish, that we can take the thematic ideas and the big picture stuff and come to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And this is the end of the story. And one of those things that people it's such a weird thing when as soon as you say you're ending something, they go, "Will it come back?" And you're like, "I get that's a really gratifying thing because people want more."
Right.
I would rather leave you wanting more than be like, "Oh, thank God, just put a bullet in its head, like just let this thing go." Like, you know, I don't want to wear out our welcome. I would rather have you a little bit hungry and just be like, "Man, that was so great. I can't wait to see what you do next," you know? And so then we move on to other cool projects rather than just run this thing into the ground, right? So we've got good momentum. We're doing well. And to be 100% honest, you know, the creator-owned market, and comics in general, people seem to be less committed to long form stories. Like, you know, more companies are putting out miniseries or graphic novels rather than, you're not going to see another Sandman. You know, you're not going to see 75 issues or 100 issue kind of stuff very much, if at all. And so our ability to do 30 issues and really cohesively tell the story, I'm really proud of it. And, you know, I hope to be able to do something longer form like that again, but I can't guarantee that that's the way the market goes, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'd rather get out while the getting is good and do something solid and finish than run out of steam or have our sales trail off to a point where it's like, we can't finish it properly.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to the entire opposite end of the spectrum from creator owned to something that is completely IP, Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons.
Right. It just seems like you're at the IP trough at that point. Like, it's crazy talk. Why? What has happened?
Yeah, brought to you by Cold Stone Creamery, right?
Right.
Well, I thought this book was great. I had a lot of fun reading this book. So it is mostly a Rick and Morty book, and then at the end they get sucked into Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
You're co-writing the book. How did that work? I mean, you were saying before we got on here that every co-writing experience is different, but I think a lot of people picture it as like, you write a line and then I write a line and then you write a line, but that's not happening.
So Patrick Rothfuss is the co-writer on this series. He's a very famous fantasy author, New York Times bestselling author. He's got a huge fan base, deep roots in fantasy sword and sorcery stuff. Kind of a nerd celebrity. He's done some, he was on the Acquisitions Incorporated with the Penny Arcade guys for one of their live play role-playing game stuff.
Oh, wow.
So he's got all the right bits in terms of that. And then I've been doing the Dungeons & Dragons comic ever since 5th edition launched. I've got deep roots in D&D. I've been playing since I was 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
First edition all the way through to now. I've been working with the Wizards of the Coast gang on the comic, and we have a great working relationship, and IDW and everyone else really loves what I'm doing. So they were like, okay, Pat deeply wants to do this thing. Jim deeply wants to do this thing. Let's, you know, hope that we've got peanut butter and chocolate and make this thing go together. And, it's been great. It's been stressful. I can't deny it because you have two huge media companies like Hasbro and Adult Swim overseeing this thing. You have two authors who are deeply passionate about these properties who want, you know, to deliver their best. And poor Troy Little, our glorious artistic collaborator, Eisner Award, you know, nominated Troy Little, who's one of the best cartoonists in the business, who's deeply trying to channel all of this madness onto the page and make it seem like this is all very smooth. And so it's been great. But, and when Pat first came to me and said, "Look, I've got kind of a mission statement," I was like, "Oh, okay, brace for impact."
Oh, boy.
And he said to me, he goes, "Look, you know, people think that Dungeons and Dragons is about, like, people who don't know better, they think that Dungeons and Dragons is about killing monsters and getting gold." And he's like, "But it's not. It's about spending time with people you like, building a story together and learning things about yourself at the same time." And he goes, people think that Rick and Morty is like edgelord nihilism and violence. And he goes, "But it's not. It's about a broken family trying to figure out how to live with each other." And I was like, "Oh, we're going to do just fine." Because you get that there's bigger thematic things there, that there's a surface level of assumptions about these properties that people have that is not completely untrue, but that there's a lot more going on under the hood. And we can do both. You know, a great Rick and Morty episode has all the violent ridiculousness and nihilistic sarcasm that that a certain fan base will love, but that you can drill down deeper and see that there's actually some really impressive storytelling and thematic stuff going on. And there's some real thought put into the emotional content of these characters. And we can do both with D&D. We can do both with Rick and Morty. And so on that level, we're in total sync. And I'm not saying this is and Pat's been totally public about this as well. Pat's a very intuitive writer. So he's just like, I feel this and I'm going to put this on the page. And I'm like super structured. I'm like, okay, we're going to build this and we're going to pay this off here and we're going to echo this here. And this is how many pages this scene is going to take. Pat's a prose writer, so if he feels it, he just writes more pages.
Oh, wow.
And comics are like, we have this many pages. And so it's been fascinating because Pat will like fire hose an insane amount of material at me. And I'm like, this is all beautiful. We have no room for any of this. This is amazing stuff, but I have no idea how we're going to fit this on the page. And the conversations, somewhere between Claremont and Bendis levels of insane amounts of text on the page, but even more like off in the weeds kind of stuff. And I'm like, this is great. We should publish like a script book afterwards because we're going to cut like 2/3 of it because we can't do panels after panels of back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But this is all great. We can use this. Look, this is the core. We're going to pull this out and we're going to get a big visual moment that Troy can build on. And you're doing a great job, Pat. And Pat's like, did I do too much? A little bit. And he admits it too. He's like, the comic form's not my thing. And then I'll send it back to him and he goes, oh yeah, no, that's really good. No, that was great. Yeah, I agree. I went a little overboard there. Yeah, just a little. It's all
well, good. And I guess it's probably also tough adding into the mix the fact that Rick and Morty is comedy, right? And is mostly verbally based. Certainly there's
sure, there's a lot
too,
of dialogue, but, and a Rick rant is a beautiful thing, right? Oh, when he goes off on a crazy, insane, nihilistic, sort of tornado of anger or frustration, it's a wonderful thing. So we do try and open ourselves up to those spaces, but you also need like, okay, we have to get them going. We have to get on the adventure now and stuff. And so Pat and I are getting along really well and sort of having fun with that interplay, but it does throw my normal structure off where I'm like, okay, we made a plan. And then all of a sudden Pat's like, but what about this? And I go, that is a good idea. I guess we'll go back and we'll see, what they're into. And, Wizards and Adult Swim have been amazing about putting up with our craziness. Like we gave them a really tight outline and we have vaguely followed it. And they have been totally cool because the material is good, because the story is good, because the character moments are really strong. But for my very, organized self, like internally, I'm just like, oh my God, I'm not being professional. And it's a whole other side of writing I'm genuinely not used to, where I'm just sort of like, normally I give you a plan and then I complete the plan. And I'm like, I gave you a plan. And then I'm like, but this is better. And we just charge off into the fray somewhere else. It's been cool.
I mean, not to read too much into it, but it certainly sounds like you're kind of the dungeon master and he's throwing the crinks and everything, right?
He is. He's definitely not following the module anymore. He's left the dungeon completely. And what's funny is like, I would be very, when we started this project, I wouldn't publicly say any of that. And then Pat and I did the D&D live stream, like, and so to tens of thousands of people on this live stream, and he's like, yeah, I'm not even following a plan anymore. Man, I don't hit my deadlines. I don't even know what I'm doing. And I'm just like, well, if you're going to say it, all right, great, no problem. But we are genuinely getting along really well. And Troy is being such a trooper. Oh my God, that guy, we send him the craziest stuff. And I send him reams and reams of reference because we go through every edition of Dungeons and Dragons. I'm like sending Troy, and the notes we give him are so pedantic. It's like, those kobolds don't look like third edition kobolds. Here's the reference, and they're this size, and this is what it should look like. Here's a map of Undermountain. Like all these ridiculous, could you make sure that the back of the first edition Dungeons Master's Guide has this graphic on it? Like, done in your cartoony style? Like, weird.
Easy enough.
Sure, right? And it's ludicrous, but the fan base appreciates it. Like, literally, the day of release on the first issue of Rick and Morty D&D, I had someone send me screenshots of some of the panels, and they were pointing out what every product was that was scattered on, like, Morty's bed. And I was like, yeah, I literally handpicked all those and said, draw this, draw that, So it's, someone's going to notice it and appreciate it because they love it as much as we do.
You're also working on the D&D Baldur's Gate series, which had a big issue recently with a hamster killing a bunch of dudes. That was crazy.
Thank you. I feel so like, so the regular Dungeons and Dragons comic series has been a series of miniseries. So when fifth edition launched, we did a miniseries called Legends of Baldur's Gate. And since then we've done three more. We did, Shadows of the Vampire, Frost Giants Fury, and recently Evil at Baldur's Gate. And they have big, broad kind of stories. You can jump in and read each one, but they connect to each other. And they use some characters from the original Baldur's Gate video games, plus so a bunch of new characters that I've created for it, which have been embraced by Wizards. And I feel very indulgent. Like, they've been amazing to me. As much as I say creator-owned stuff can be indulgent, the free reign that Wizards of the Coast has given me on the D&D series has been ridiculous. Nice. So Evil at Baldur's Gate was a unique one where we had each issue was sort of a solo where we focused on each of the characters in the party. And the fifth one is about, so there's this character called Minsk, and he's from Baldur's Gate, and he's this kind of brain-addled ranger who will be a hero no matter what. He's the classic, like, Leroy Jenkins before there was a Leroy Jenkins. So he will charge into the fray, kick a door down, and scream, you know, I'm the big hero, and go suicidally into combat, which is actually an amazing character to have in a story, because if things ever get bored, he's also bored, and he'll just jump out a window. So, like, great character, awesome. And he's beloved, kind of this cult figure in Dungeons and Dragons. He's voiced by Jim Cummings. Like, he is this really awesome character from the games. And I found a way to bring him back because, oh, comics and games. The current timeline of Forgotten Realms is over 100 years after those video games. So he's a human. He should be long dead. And they don't do time travel in Dungeons and Dragons. So I did a crazy callback to a side quest that's in Baldur's Gate where you find a statue of someone and you turn them back to human, and they've been stuck that way for years. So I had it that after the video games, Minsk and Boo, so Boo is Minsk's animal companion. He's a hamster, which is an unusual.
As you do. Yeah.
He got turned into a statue and eventually was put into the square in Baldur's Gate because they thought it was a statue someone had carved. And it's a statue to the legendary ranger, and it sat there for like 90 years. And then he got turned back to normal. And so now he's in the current Forgotten Realms. And because of that story, he's now being used in the video games. He's being used in a bunch of ancillary products. When I went to the D&D offices back in October, they toured me around the office and introduced me as Jim is the keeper of Minsk and Boo.
Wow.
Like, you know,
now you're famous.
My heart was 10 times bigger that day. It was really cool. And so getting to write him and getting to write sort of the new characters that he's surrounded himself with on adventures is just been an absolute blast. And on Evil and Baldur's Gate, I said, we're going to do these 5 one-shot stories. So we did some really weird, indulgent stuff. We have one issue where we go to one of the other planes of existence, which is like deep D&D lore that normal people would not understand. But I just did a whole issue on it, and the fan base was like, holy crap, I can't believe you're digging deep into this stuff. And then the fifth issue is literally Boo the hamster on what we call Hamster Quest. It's a solo adventure, and it's just ridiculously cute. Like, it's the Dungeons and Dragons equivalent of like Air Bud. Like, it's just it's the pet is smarter than everyone else. He's going to save everybody, but we're going to do it with such aplomb, and we're going to do it with such joy that you can't help but kind of root for him.
Yeah.
So we had an absolute blast.
Yeah, it definitely seems like if you're going to do a spinoff miniseries, make it about the hamster going forward.
Right, and it does help that it has the cutest cover I think I've ever seen. So it's Max Dunbar did this lineup of I think like 16 Boos and all the different emotional states of Boo, whether he's hungry or excited or cold or sleepy. And so people have been using them as like Twitter avatars and stuff. It's been awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. This is my job. I get to write about violent medieval hamsters.
I mean, that's ideal. That or what was it? Monster monster researcher.
Yeah, if you can be a monster scholar or monster a comic scholar. Writer, there's pretty good.
Those are top two jobs.
Yeah, I think so.
We're going to get to your guys' questions in a bit, but I do want to talk about Champions. Right. Particularly, you had a huge issue that came out this past week.
Less hamsters.
Yeah, slightly less hamsters. Yes. Slightly more serious. It dealt, not to talk about it right thing in the morning, but it dealt with school shootings.
Yes.
Through the lens of the Champions, who are the teen heroes in the Marvel Universe right now. The thing that I thought was really interesting about the book is it dealt with the impact of the event, spoiler, but it happens at Miles Morales' school while he's away. He comes back, he sees the repercussions of it, and it's basically just the characters emotionally dealing with it. It's not anybody punching anything, there's not Dr. Doom didn't do it or anything like that. It's just purely deals with the emotions there, almost in an apolitical way in a certain sense.
Right.
First of all, how did the idea of the issue get broached, and then what did it have to go through behind the scenes to get made?
So like all of my rambling stories here, I'll come around to how it actually happened.
Yeah.
First off, really incredibly proud of the issue. The response that we got, you know, Wednesday and all the way through the weekend has been phenomenal. Our whole team worked their butt off on it. So everyone, you know, Sean Isaac and our colorist and letterer and editorial, everyone at every level, was incredible on this book. And I feel really, really, honestly, like, I hate using this word because people think that you're putting an affectation on, like, I'm honored that we were able to do this and that it worked so well. And on that note, like Tom Brevoort and Alana Smith, my editors on Champions, have been so wonderful on the series. I took over at issue 19, and I love the book. It's, like you said, the new sort of generation of heroes at Marvel. And I was taken over from Mark Waid and Humberto Ramos, and I said, I cannot be Mark Waid. I love Mark Waid. I think he's an amazing writer. I don't write the same kinds of stories he does. And Tom's like, no, we're bringing you on to be you. I was like, okay. And one of the reasons why I love having Tom as an editor, and he's probably the best editor I've ever had, is he said to me, the very first meeting we ever had at Marvel, he said, I want you to know something. I can be convinced of things. I was like, okay, that's a weird way to start a meeting. He goes, some editors want basically writers to be their hands and to be the proxy for their ideas. I want you to be you. I've been in this business long enough. I don't need to indulge myself. I want you to do what you do best and be passionate about those stories and tell the kinds of stories that you think are going to work. And if I'm not convinced of those, convince me. Put the work into it. Put the pitch together. Do your homework. Make me as excited about it as you are, and then I will go to bat for you. And that's if they're strange stories, if they're difficult stories, if they're indulgent stories. And I've done that. So I've done, you know, in our first story arc, we introduced a new Canadian superhero because I'm a Canadian guy and I want more Canadian content in Marvel. But I justified it with, here's a cool story, here's a cool character idea. And Tom backed me up. You know, I said, I want to have the man thing show up in an issue of Champions. And he goes, why? How does that fit? Well, let me convince you. And I convinced him that there's a way that we could talk about teen angst through the lens of whosoever knows fear burns at the touch of the man thing. Cool. He backs me up. We get to do it. And then I came to him with, you know, there've been a spate of shootings. I wish I could say this year, every year in America. And I felt really strongly that of all the books at Marvel, we had the platform because we had the most heroes that were teenagers in high schools, that they could show, we could show something, we could say something, powerful. And it would have been so easy for Tom to just say, no, just whiff on it. Totally reasonable for him to say, hey, you know what? The biggest entertainment company in the world is not going to step into this, is not going to hit this hot button issue. We have no need to. It's not going to help our bottom line. And he didn't. He just said, pitch it to me. Make me believe that this is going to work, and then I'll take it up the ladder. And so I put the pitch together, and I said, this is my angle on it. I think this can work. He believed in it. Backed me on it, took it up to the next level, It went, you know, through C.B. Cebulski, Joe Quesada, and Salman Aminat. It went up to Dan Buckley. Like, everybody gave their feedback on it, and no one said no. Everyone said, yeah, this is like, you know, Stan did some of those world outside your window kind of issues, and Marvel has a legacy of doing powerful, real life kind of stories through the lens of superheroics. We can do this. We just have to make sure we, you know, cross our T's and dot our I's on it. And we gave ourselves extra time to develop it. And I kept waiting for it to get rejected through the process. And I wouldn't have been angry. I would have been sad, because obviously you want to see something carry through that you believe in. But I wouldn't have, been surprised that would have seemed like a natural choice. And the fact we were actually able to carry it through and deliver it, and everyone, like I said, involved was so supportive, means a lot to me. And it makes a very corporate work for hire gig feel very personal, that I'm allowed to, you know, swing for the fences with an emotional story like this. I mean, Miles Morales has a movie coming out. You know what I mean? Like, of all the times for us to do this, this would have been the time for them to say no on so many levels. And no one did. Everyone backed us. The book came out. I think it's beautiful. The response we've been getting from retailers and readers and educators and all kinds of different people has been incredibly powerful. And so, that's how it came about.
Now, it is very powerful. And what's great is, like, you know, when you know you're going to read a thing like this, there's a little bit of like, all right, here we go. How is this going to get done?
But, and that's why that first page actually has, we now interrupt you for this bulletin. There's a black page with the white text.
Yeah.
And every part of this issue went back and forth discussing, you know, the best way to do it. And that was in there for a very specific reason. The last time they used that page was on the 9/11 issue of Amazing Spider-Man. And it becomes almost like a narrative airlock. Like, you're telling people, this is not a regular issue. This is not a regular theme. Get ready. You know what I mean? Brace yourself. Mm-hmm. This is going to be intense. And I think that's kind of valuable. When you watch a TV show and they have the opening credits, it's like a narrative airlock. It's getting you ready for action, adventure, romance, comedy, whatever the particular thing you're going to be experiencing in the next half hour or 45 minutes or whatever. And in this particular case, we're like, well, we don't want a peppy recap page, and we don't want to just pretend it's a regular issue. How do we, you know, strike that balance with it?
Yeah. And what's great is not only is the writing good, but also just the panels where there are no text of like the drill that they go through to see the faces of the students is just so powerful.
Yeah. And Sean Isaac, the artist on the issue, he lives in South Africa, and we sent tons of reference over. And I think the saddest thing, I mean, there's so many sad things about the what's going on, but I sent him a bunch of news reports about these, what they call active shooter drills. Mm-hmm. So in the same way you'd have a fire drill at a school, they will literally pretend there's a shooter running around killing people, and teachers will brace their door and then tell all the kids to, crowd into the back of the room behind the desk and stay together while they, pretend there's people dying outside.
Yeah.
And I was like, my God, this is a real thing that people do. And we're going to show this just unvarnished. And I didn't have to embellish it. This isn't a supervillain with the power cosmic or a world eating monster. This is just 2018. And that I sent that, and Sean was just like, this is crazy. Like, this doesn't make any sense. And I was like, and yet here we are. There's your reference. You know, have at it. And he didn't have to embellish or exaggerate. He didn't have to play it up or make it seem, we weren't viewing it through a fictional exaggeration. It was just in that scene, Kamala Khan's school has an active shooter drill, and the looks on their faces and the feeling that the dread that washes over those pages required no dialogue.
Yeah.
I just had to show it as it was, unvarnished, and it works.
Yeah.
It's a powerful scene and it speaks for itself.
Yeah, it really does.
Do you feel like, is there more you have to say with these characters about this issue, or did you say what you needed to say on this issue?
I didn't want it to, yes, I hate using this term, it's a very special issue of Champions, but it is part and parcel now of the ongoing story. The deaths that happen at Brooklyn Visions Academy have affected Miles Morales, and it will come back again. Not another shooting, but the things that Miles feels and the fears that he has around that are now part of the ongoing story that we're exploring. And that guilt and that frustration is not going to go away. I pitched a really crazy story for 2019, and there's a thematic moment that drilled right into the center of it where the things that Kamala says to Miles at the end to try and pull him out of this, you know, depressive sort of tailspin that he's in will come back, and that he needs those words again and she needs those words again because other difficult things are coming for them. I feel it's really important to make these stories about these heroes dramatic and powerful. I don't want to use kid gloves just because they're kids. The best books that I love growing up, you know, in teen books particularly, whether that's Teen Titans or New Mutants or, you know, X-Men and stuff like that, they didn't shy away from intense emotion and difficult decisions for characters. And the fact that they were able to overcome and sometimes stumble, fall really far, and then pull themselves out is what made me love those characters. And I want people to love the Champions. I want them to love all these young heroes because we put them through the, you know, the grinder, and they step back up and they become the heroes that we know they can be, and not always unscarred. You know what I mean? And so this is part of that. This is part of an ongoing process with these characters where I want them to be pushed to their limit to show you their heroism.
Well, I just want to say I'm glad that you fought to get that issue made, because it was really powerful, and I was really glad that I read it afterwards.
Yeah, you know, it feels weird to be in the thick of it, and to have it right up until they were shipping to the stores. I had this weird fear that it was going to get pulled, not because of anything specific anyone had said, but because you just don't know. You just don't know if the corporate structure will take hold and someone will say, this is a bad idea, let's just avoid it, you know? And we all had to kind of internally accept that that was a possibility. And then when retailers started to literally be taking photos of it at their stores and say, I love this issue, you know, we're putting it by the cash register, I want people to read it. And I was like, oh, it's real now. Like, they could technically do like a, you know, we got to take these back and a bunch of retailers will hide them and hoard them. But it's real now. It's out there. And we did it. You know, that was a really cool feeling. And I hope that the issue lasts in the sense that there's something important to be said. This is awful saying this. Because we did an extra long development period on this issue, because we didn't know, you know, when it would come out, if it would get approved, all these sorts of things. I was on a meeting with a bunch of different people, a phone meeting, and we were talking about timing. And I said, I would like for it to come out in September because, you know, school's back and things like this. I think it's the strongest point for us to release it. And someone else on the call was saying, well, you know, but that's a ways away. Like, you know, what if it's not timely? And then someone else on the call just said, it will always be timely.
Yeah.
And we all just this silence, and we were like, well, moving on. Like, yeah. You know, that just thinking about that we could have released it a year from now. We could release it, who knows, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, and it will probably strike the same chord. That terrifies me. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do think, I mean, not to get too philosophical about this, but I do think you release media like this and you have people who are reading characters like Miles Morales and Kamala Khan and others dealing with it, and it affects you as a kid. I remember reading comics like this and it affecting and changing the entire way I viewed my life going forward. So hopefully.
We were ready for like a lot more criticism on the issue. The only small criticism I got was, you know, someone said, well, they're not saying anything that hasn't been said before. And I was like, sure. But if you were 12 and you haven't really, engaged this subject before, maybe it is saying something new. Maybe it's saying it in a way that you haven't heard before or from characters that you respect and know and believe in the way that we do when we're younger. In this fiction has so much more power to us, like you're sort of saying, you know. We're not going to solve this with a comic, but that doesn't mean that we don't have something to say about hope versus despair or our ability to get through traumatic situations.
Yeah. All right. To take a little bit of a left turn, though, we will move into your guys' questions. We got a couple of prizes for you guys. We got some stacks of free comics. Also, the past 2 days, I was at Universal Studios Florida. Not trying to brag, but I brought you guys back some presents.
What?
Yeah, we have some Avengers chocolate bars direct from Florida. They have extra alligators in them. They're made with milk chocolate and popping candy.
Popping so candy? What does that mean?
It's like Pop Rocks.
What are you
and
giving
chocolate.
People?
What? It's poison.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
It's cool. Don't worry about it, you guys. So I'm going to come out to you. If you have a question specifically for Jim, that's great. If you have a general question about, you know, who would win in a fight, that's great, too. If you want some romance advice.
Everything we say here on the panel is yes. canon. So.
Yeah, if you want to know where the best poutine is in Philadelphia, we'll let you know. So just raise your hand if you got a question. Can be something simple. And yes, you, sir. What is your name and what is your question?
It's John, and taking a hard right turn back to the school shootings, considering the audience, like the stereotypical audience of comic books, do you think there's a limit to the social issues you can really address? Like, could you do criminal justice?
I mean, it's hard to say, right? Like, it all depends. Everything through the lens. Like, you know, back in the 60s, Star Trek would do all sorts of amazing stories about social trends and issues that were happening in the day, but they were doing it through a lens of fiction, right? So they could talk about racism, or they could talk about Vietnam, or they could talk about all these big issues, but they're doing it through a bit of a different lens, right? So I think for some of them, you need to mix in more fiction, and some of them you can sort of unfiltered talk directly about the subject as is. But if it is an emotional story and a dramatic story, there's something there to be that you can work with. You know what I mean? It's just whether or not it's direct or more broad. So we can talk about injustice in the world. We can talk about sexism or racism or things like that, but it's how you treat it. It's, you know, hitting it with a hammer or coming at it in a much more kind of elegant way. And what you ideally don't want to do is literally just have page after page of characters wagging their finger and preaching at you and saying, this is the correct answer to the problem. What you want to do is the best kinds of stories, at least for me and a lot of the other people that I think do it well, we never tell you an answer to an equation. So we don't say 2 + 2 = 4. What we say is 2 + 2. And you look and you go, my God, it's 4. You know what I mean? So if we create all these great ingredients and we say, look at all these different things. I've been asked multiple times this week, how should people react to Champions number 24? If I have to tell you, I didn't do my job. Right. If I have to get up on a pedestal and say, and you will feel this and this will make you want to go do this and vote for so and so, then it's a complete failure, because the storytelling is there to build an emotional quality to it and to give you things to think about and what you want to do with them and what it makes you want to change about the country is up to you. You know what I mean? That's, as a storyteller, is not my job. You know, I do the best I can to put those ingredients into place. And then you have to do, you take it and it inspires you in the way that it inspires you. It makes you feel or think or do the things you're going to do. One of the things I recommend to people when they're pitching stories is not to activate an editor with a particular word. So if in a pitch you have to tell people it's funny, or you have to tell people it's scary, or you have to tell people it's unsettling, then you have been ineffective in your pitch. What I want to do is tell you a bunch of things, and then you, as the editor or the publisher, say, oh, that sounds really creepy. You're like, yeah, it does, doesn't it? So it worked. I wanted you to be creeped out, and I gave you all the ingredients for you to tell me it's creepy. Or I tell you a bunch of kooky stuff, and then you go, oh, that's really funny. I'm like, yep. If I have to say, this is a really funny story, we lost. We've already failed. And I feel like some of the well-meaning political stories sometimes come out and people are a little too heavy on that aspect of, I'm going to wag my finger and tell you to be sad, to be afraid, to be, you know, motivated, rather than giving you all the ingredients and having you say, I'm sad, I'm afraid, I'm motivated, or I'm whatever. And I think it comes from a natural place of, wanting that end result and being afraid of not people not getting it. Do you know what I mean? And so that's the balance for me, is like a story that's too preachy, too much, too on the nose, instead of giving you all those elements and then you being very naturally swept up in them.
I think about those issues all the time on both sides of the spectrum. I mean, I'm sure most folks can mention things, but I think about like the North Star coming out issue from Alpha Flight, which was blunt like that, unfortunately. Sure. Or the Doctor Doom 9/11 issue where he's crying and that gets passed around a lot.
It's a Spider-Man issue. And
yes,
Doctor Doom's
sorry.
In one panel.
Sorry so about that.
Let's put the proper spin on that.
Yeah. I'm not really a comic book fan.
That's all.
But then I also think about things. There was this issue, I think it was Power Pack and X-Men Heroes for Hope, where they went to Africa and all the proceeds went to hunger, where it, at the same time, it was very blunt, but it still worked because they came up with a powerful story with good creators.
Right.
So I think you can get both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a, but again, it's like, if you have to have like one page of like a superhero looking directly at the reader and saying, got to do this, got to do that, then I feel like you've lost the plot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like a good dramatic story brings people into the world and the concept and makes it very clear where we're going, what a message could be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like the end of On Deadly Ground with Steven Seagal when he comes out and gives the lecture at the end of the movie. I was like, good movie up until then. Come on.
That was exactly what I was thinking.
Oh my God.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. I've never seen that film.
Don't watch that movie.
Yeah, don't.
Do we have other questions? Yes. Here, let me run back to
you. Wait for the mic.
Here, come on. Yeah. No. We're recording it for a podcast. You're going to be famous online. What's your name? What's your question?
Internet famous.
My name is John, and my question goes back to the concept of topics.
Sure.
Have you, and not only specific to the champion one that you just mentioned,
yeah.
the school shooting, but have you done something?
Every issue of Champions is really dark, by the
right.
way. You guys should totally read this series. It's usually a lot of fun, and it's a very uplifting kind of classic superhero teen comic. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. Have you ever gone through with a topic that then you've gotten negative feedback on, hey, you've crossed the line, really?
Absolutely. I mean, one of those things, so I've written quite a few superhero comics. I don't know if you know this, superhero fans are really opinionated. And that's cool. Like, I'd rather that people are passionate and engaged in this stuff than the most terrifying thing to an author is silence. If no one's reading, if no one's commenting, if no one's engaged, oh man, I'm doomed, right? I'm not trying to kick a hornet's nest on purpose in the sense that I don't want people angry at me, but I also think that it's important to build drama and excitement and things like that. And giving readers a roller coaster ride of an experience. There's a certain segment of fandom that loves these characters and wants them to be safe. And I know that sounds dorky, but it's not. You know, they love these characters. I was writing Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, and Bucky's been through a lot. He's had a torturous life and done dark things and wants to redeem himself. And there's a big passionate part of the fandom that wants him to be redeemed and safe now. And that it will not happen because the soap opera of the Marvel Universe will not allow this merry-go-round to end. And that's okay. But you get these messages from people like, why are you hurting these characters? Why are you doing this? I thought you liked Bucky Barnes. Sam Alexander, the young Nova, he's had a couple solo books. He's done a bunch of things. He's on the Champions team. And people are like, I really hope we see more of Sam Alexander. I said, oh, you will. And then we basically pushed him into the mud, stole his helmet so he no longer has the Nova power. And he hates everyone and he's bitter and angry right now and trying to figure out how he fits on a team of superheroes without any superpowers. And then readers were like, not like that. Don't do that. Sam's such a good kid. He is a good kid. Why are you being so mean? I thought you liked Sam Alexander. I love Sam Alexander. And I'm going to show you how Sam, you know, pushes through one of the most difficult times of his life. But that requires an ongoing serialized story. And you are at Empire Strikes Back and you want an Ewok dance. And we're not there yet. You know what I mean? Like, so it's an interesting kind of process with serialized fiction where when you're in the dark spots, when you're in the difficult evolutions of a character, there are gaps, monthly gaps in this story, and people want what they want. And I can't, I don't want to reveal the plot. I don't want to spoilers. Everything's going to be okay. You're like, have you read a comic before? You know, like, I don't want to be that guy, but sometimes it can be aggravating where people are like, they want step six and we're on step two and you're just there. They want what they want. You know, the romance thing, we get a lot of people. Why aren't these characters together? You seem to be teasing that these two characters are going to get together. You're like, yep. Well, get on it already. Well, you're clearly engaged and wanting to see what happens, right? Maybe we pull this taffy a little bit more there. And it, I'm not doing it to be mean. It's a natural part of entertainment and drama and the whole 10 yards. You know what I mean? So many fictional stories actually break down when you get everything you want, when the romance happens, when the victory is there. It's a very different story at that point. You need to put new roadblocks in the way of these characters. We want to see them come up against, you know, adversity and difficulty. And so it's a funny part because every so often I'll, like, you know, want to pull my hair out and I'm talking to my wife and I'm just like, what I need to do is just do a text summary at the end of the issue. Don't worry, it'll all be okay. These guys are going to fall in love. This is what happens. They all get rich and go off and have children. Like, because seemingly that's what the fans want. She goes, you know, that's not what they want. I'm like, but you'd think they would if you read Twitter, you know? And so I have to kind of step back and go, slow down. You know, we have tens of thousands of readers and there are 50 of them that are in your face on Twitter that want these people sucking face and these people, you know, hate each other and these people beat this villain or this person happy. That's not the full readership. That's not, you know, the norm. It is valuable information to know what people are passionate about. It's amazing to have that kind of passion and readership, but it's also just part of a broader conversation.
Yeah. The comic industry has played with this a lot, a bunch of different times, and I don't think this necessarily would solve this problem, but how do you feel about moving publishers like Marvel and DC more towards OGNs versus serialized stories?
It's a constant, you know, conversation about, I think everyone, you know, proletizes the maybe death of the single issue or what sort of future that it has in the ongoing kind of superhero story. You know, already you're seeing the book market is very powerful. Comic book store sales are going through, you know, upheavals as they always do. And what future does it take as a, you know, boutique going to get 20 issue, 20 page story every month kind of format? It's hard to say, right? I think you can argue all sorts of different values on what the market needs. And everyone in comics argues nigh constantly over pints every night of every convention and thinks they have the solution to the problem. And I am not, I don't have this. I have my own opinions, but I don't think that those are necessarily like the silver bullet for the problem. I think you're going to see a lot of testing of this stuff. You know, DC's young graphic novel line, I forget what's called, Zoom or something that they're doing, I think is a really cool idea. I think trying to capture that young readership is powerful and important. You know, Marvel's licensed their characters to IDW to do these young, kind of younger reader comics. You know, the fan base wants, and I use this with hanging air quotes, stories that matter to the ongoing continuity, which is another huge sort of argument, good, bad, for and against. And there's times when I'm on both sides of that fence. It's no longer, as a reader, I had a very simple opinion on it. And now as a creator, I can see a lot more angles on creativity and on delivery and on audience and on potential. And so I'm not just trying to whiff on the answer, but it's like, it's complicated. I wish it was as simple as just saying, here's the format that everyone wants. But what has been amazing about the current industry is some people want digital, some people want to binge read, some people want an all-in-one subscription, you know, flat fee. Some people want to piecemeal buy exactly what they want, when they want it, how they want it. Some people, obviously, a big portion of the audience wants a physical comic in their hands. And so how do you please all these people? Well, you kind of don't. If anything, what new media seems to be about is tailor-making your experience. That you want to watch what you want, when you want, where you want, on your phone, on a 100-inch television, in your, you know, on your laptop, on your lap, in a car, you know, on a plane. People want what they want. And so comics is, I think, what they're going to have to understand is that media is splintering. What is true of all media right now is all these streaming platforms and all these movie delivery devices and all this stuff. You don't have one killer thing anymore. You have thousands and thousands of options. And on aggregate, these companies are making lots of money. So rather than comics being, you know, we're not going to be able to defy that. We have to be flexible. Certain projects will require certain formats. Certain types of stories require certain delivery mediums, but you want to broaden that base as much as possible so people can get on board. What I think comics have been really bad at, since the real intense rise of the direct market, has been pushing out young readers and not making them feel like they're invited into it, you know. And then not just in that idyllic, I wish there were still spinner racks in the corner store kind of way, but very much in a price point, you know, and availability and whatever form that takes. And I don't want to sit there and you know, in some ways it's an incredible idyllic time because my mother knows who Rocket Raccoon is. Like, that's weird, right? Like, how did this happen? We got to a point where every character is available and being turned into movies and television, and the general public's perception of comics has never been wider and more accepted. And yet the single issue sales are not great, you know? Right. So why? What is that? And it's the conversation comic book professionals love best, and we talk about it every day.
I'll tell you what. Why don't we solve it right here?
Sure.
I think that's good. Let's just figure it out.
We
just
got this
quick.
All.
We got a couple of minutes left in the panel, so I think we can figure it out.
It's a good 30-second summary.
Yeah, totally.
We got it all figured. And what's interesting is hearing some comic professionals get angry at the pop culture supremacy that we have. I was like, it was one of the weirdest conversations I had with a pro recently. I don't want to talk out of school who it was. And they were really angry about Marvel movies and absolute media dominance. And I was like, why? And they basically said, well, because it used to be, if you wanted Captain America, the only place you could get Captain America was in a comic. So if you were a fan of Captain America, you'd go read a comic. Well, now you could be a fan of Captain America and never touch a comic book because you can play a video game and you can have a t-shirt and you can go to the movies and you can get all the toys, and comics are somewhere low to nil on that priority list. And that's why it's bad. And I was just like, whoa. Like, I vaguely understand. I agree in the sense that, yeah, it would be great if people thought of comics first.
Yeah.
But really, this is bad? Yeah. Really? Really?
I think it's all right.
Yeah, I think it's pretty darn good. You know, I don't mind having the word Avengers after my name. It's kind of cool. You know, it's nice. Everyone knows what that is. I had a weird experience last year where I was crossing the border. I'm from Canada. coming here into the U.S. For New York Comic Con. And the border, I just forgot the name, agent, whatever you call it. The person's got to stamp your passport, right. Ask you what you're doing.
Yeah, border agent.
Border agent. He says, you know, where are you going? Is this for business? Yes, I'm going to New York for a convention. What kind of convention? Comics and pop culture. And he goes, for your job? I was like, yeah, what do you do? I write comic books. And he just goes, oh yeah, like one cocked eyebrow. Well, anything I've heard of? And I said, The Avengers. And he looks at me and his eyes bug out and he's just like, they hire Canadians to do that? And I was like, sometimes, you know. He goes, like the Avengers? And I was like, yeah. Oh man, my buddy's gonna freak out when I tell him about this. I was like, yeah. And then he just starts telling me about how much he loved comics growing up and how much he loves the movies and his favorite Marvel moments and all this stuff. And I'm like, cool, yeah, man, that's awesome. And the line's getting longer behind me. And the people in line are probably like, this guy's getting grilled. Yeah. They're gonna start strip searching him right there on the spot. And I'm getting nervous, like, is he gonna let me through? Or is he just gonna take me to a back room to ask me 4,000 questions about Marvel comics? And then we had this awkward pause and he goes, oh yeah, no, have a good trip. Boom. And he just hits the stamp and, wow. And I walk through. I was like, that's cool. Like, that's neat. Interesting. This is where we're at now. This is where comics are at. This is where the brands are at, you know?
And that border agent is coming for your job now.
That's right. That's right.
We are running a little low on time. So, if there is a quick question, we can take it.
All right. Hold on. Let me come over to you. What is your name and what's your question?
My name is Ray, and I don't know if this is a quick question, but we're talking about the changes in things that have happened while you're a writer, so yeah. School shootings, and also changes in technology and how things are much more available on different platforms. How have those changes affected you as a writer?
I mean, the technology's unbelievable. I can do my job from anywhere now, so I write comic books while I'm on flights. You know, the pop culture visibility of comics has never been stronger. So we get invitations, and my wife and I have been going to cities all over the world for comics, which my parents think is utterly bonkers as well. I'll tell them, oh yeah, we got an invitation to go to Johannesburg, South Africa. And my mom's like, for comics. I'm like, yep, we're going. You know, this November, I'm going to Vienna, Austria to sign comic books. Wow. I've been to England, you know, Japan, all over the U.S. and different locations thanks to that. And I can still do my job pretty much anywhere. You know, depending on the time zone, I might have to slap myself awake for a conference call on Skype. But for the most part, I can do this job anywhere. The technology, the flexibility of that is incredible. I can be here at a convention and I can check a proof on a book going through on my phone and be like, looks good, you know, hit send and I get to do my job. That is unbelievable as a process, as a research process. I can look up things instantaneously. I can have thousands and thousands of comics on my tablet that I use for reading, for research, or to check continuity or all those things. So in that way, like the modern world has been utterly brilliant and wonderful, you know what I mean? But the ubiquitous nature of it is also a little bit strange in the sense that the preciousness of a printed comic and that single issue is no longer kind of the only way that people get it. So I can see the strata of people who are hardcore collectors and they bring me those issues. And then there are, you know, the whole spectrum. I've literally put people come to my table and they say, I don't have anything for you to sign. It's just really nice to meet you. I just read it on my tablet. Cool. All right, bye. You know, like, it's, you know, you're so used to the interaction of like, here's a book, here's a signature, here's a thing. And there's a whole other audience that isn't doing physical objects anymore. And that's totally fine. I'm in that same boat. I wish I was in that same boat. My house is covered in comics. But, you know, it's been a really cool and exciting time. You know, it's a weird time too, because with the nature of everyone knowing Marvel and DC stuff, my parents know what this stuff is now and their neighbors know and my friends from high school know. So they assume like I'm friends with Robert Downey Jr. We all hang out or something. Like there's a real, they don't understand the context of it. In one way, they think I must be part of all of it or none of it. Like literally when I first started writing for Marvel, my parents have no love of comics. They've never read them. They didn't grow up on any of the stuff. They're not even sci-fi or fantasy, nothing. And they started going to the Marvel movies. And I was like, why? And Dad goes, well, that helps you, right? I was like, sure. You know, your, you know, $11 ticket to the movies to the Marvel Entertainment Corporation in some vague, ludicrous, obtuse way, I guess, filters its way down into my pocket. But no, you know, like, yeah, it's really, you know, you don't have to go out there and buy Iron Man toys or anything. But it's nice. Like it's very, you know, it's heartfelt. It's sweet. Cool. So yeah, it's, I don't know if I'm fully answering your questions. It's an exciting and weird time. It's cool.
Cool. All right. We are going to have to let you go. Before we do though, plug your stuff. What's coming up that people should check out?
If you want to find out more about what I'm doing, the best place is jimzub.com. So JIMZUB.com. On there, I've got obviously like listings to upcoming books that I'm doing, interviews. I also have tutorials about how to write comics, pitch comic book stories, some of the economics of creator-owned comics and things like that. The final issue of Wayward comes out in October. Rick and Morty versus Dungeons and Dragons is a 4-issue miniseries running through the fall. I've got more D&D comics coming in the new year. Champions is ongoing monthly at Marvel, and I have sort of two Marvel project announcements that should be coming out either before or around New York Comic Con. So they are keeping me good and busy at the House of Ideas.
Yeah, just a couple of things coming out, just a few.
One or two.
All right. A couple of things from us before we go. If you're ever in New York, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater Loft. That's totally free. It's also a podcast and goes out online. Got some postcards over here if you want to grab some info on that. Also, if you want to support the show, we do a Patreon, patreon.com/comicbookclub. We have amazing supporters like these two folks in the front row here, Aaron and John. We'll give them a big round of applause.
Yeah. Ooh,
they help keep the show going. So you can check that out. We got a private Slack that you can hang out in. It's pretty cool. It was real cool. And some other stuff. And we do a bunch more podcasts. You can check out at comicbookclublive.com. Pete, anything you want to plug?
Yes, friend us on Facebook so you get to know about the amazing guests we have on our show.
And follow us on Twitter at comicbooklive. Thank you so much to Keystone Comic Con for having us here. Enjoy the rest of the convention, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out. Bye-bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Big round of applause for Jim also.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.